Welcome to the University of Nottingham podcast.
Coming up this week, 10 years to the day after the Good Friday Agreement was signed, Professor Stefan Wolf asks whether the peace process in Northern Ireland could help countries like Iraq.
There are some very important lessons from Northern Ireland that we can learn here.
He also weighs up the importance of Ian Paisley's involvement.
He commands this great level of respect and authority. He actually is a very, very smart and clever politician that not only has his own interests in mind, but a politician that really looks out for the people that he is representing. And I think that is, unfortunately, a very rare situation in many other conflicts.
If I had said to you 10 years ago that Ian Paisley and the likes of Gerry Adams would be sitting down at the same table in a decade's time, would you have called for the straitjacket, or would that have been a reasonable prediction at that time?
I think 10 years ago that was still very much a hope that people might have had. And certainly 10 years ago I think it looked much more that the DUP, Ian Paisley's party, would permanently, or at least for a very long time, stay outside the political process, and that it was much more so-called moderate parties and Sinn Féin that had found an agreement and were willing and able to work it out. But then what we have seen over the past 10 years is actually a very interesting trend, that what used to be the extreme parties moved much more into the center, and in the process of doing so, they actually began to engage with each other to iron out some of the problems that the 1998 agreement on Northern Ireland still had. And then 8 years on, in 2006, we finally got an agreement to which everybody signed up. And since the elections of last year, we have what nobody ever thought would be possible, a joint team of First and Deputy First Minister coming from the DUP and Sinn Féin.
How significant was the Good Friday Agreement?
Oh, very instrumental, I think, because it showed for the very first time that you could actually make a deal to which the moderate parties on both sides and Sinn Féin could sign up to. And it was also instrumental in eventually bringing about the complete decommissioning and disbanding, if you want, of the Irish Republican Army, which was always one of the major stumbling blocks in the way in which unionists and loyalists wanted to engage with their opposites on the nationalist and republican side. So I think from that perspective, even though now with the benefit of hindsight we can see that there were many institutional structural problems in the agreement of 1998, we can also see that what it did facilitate was forever and permanently taking the gun out of politics in Northern Ireland. And that eventually contributed in a very significant way to making it possible for Ian Paisley and the DUP to engage constructively into a negotiation process with Sinn Féin, at the end of which we have the agreement at St Andrews in 2006.
Because, I mean, Ian Paisley once famously said, a much louder, booming voice than I'm capable of, but he said that I will go to the grave with the convictions I have. At that time, it just seemed ludicrous to even consider that they'd ever get to a point where they could sit down.
Ian Paisley probably, at the end of the day, so to speak, can stand up and say that he is taking his convictions to the grave, in the sense that he didn't want to sell out, as he would call it. He didn't want to let Northern Ireland become part of the Republic of Ireland. And one should also add that he has been rumoured, and quite credibly, I would say, that he was ready to make a deal as early as the 1970s with the Nationalist Social Democratic and Labour Party to have a power-sharing government. Now, the situation in the 1970s was obviously very, very different from what it is now, 30 years later, but I think it is very much to the credit of Ian Paisley that he has taken this opportunity now to really make a leap, to some extent into the dark, because he also didn't exactly know how it would work out and how much support he would get from his constituents for making that deal in St Andrews and then subsequently accepting a joint government with Sinn Féin. And he personally, I think, found it very hard to hear some of the rejections from his own erstwhile supporters. But on the other hand, it's also very important to realize that probably only Ian Paisley could have made this deal, because he commands this great level of respect and authority as the probably staunchest defender of Ulster Unionists. And if it hadn't been for him, so to speak, then I think it would have been very difficult for anybody else in the Democratic Unionist Party to basically bring Unionists along. And we have seen the failures of David Trimble after 1998, who was also a fairly popular Unionist leader, but he didn't command the same level of respect and authority as Ian Paisley. So Paisley doing the deal in 2007 and now running with it for a year and handing over to whoever that might be in the end, I think this is really illustrates that Paisley is, against many predictions and against many things that people might have said about him only a year or two ago, he actually is a very, very smart and clever politician that not only has his own interests in mind, but that really a politician that really looks out for the people that he is representing. And I think that is unfortunately a very rare situation in many other conflicts. So I think also from this personal example that Paisley and others in Northern Ireland have said, I think important lessons can be drawn that other politicians should really take as an example.
Looking at the devolved government now and what's coming up, how realistic is it to expect everything just to slot into place?
Well, I think over the past year, it hasn't necessarily been an easy process, but it has been a constructive process. And the two main parties in government now, DUP and Sinn Féin, have worked very well together, both at the level of their actual leaders as well as at the level of their parliamentary parties. Also, we have seen that the SDLP, the National Social Democrats, and the Ulster Unionist Party of formerly David Trimble, who was one of the signatories of the Good Friday Agreement and subsequent recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, they actually have also bought into this process. And obviously, it's been a disappointment for them not to be the leading parties in the new government. But from that perspective, I don't see at the moment any significant spoilers in Northern Ireland that could derail process. And as long as the political parties in general remain committed to working within the institutional structures that have been established, I think that any problems that might come along can be worked out without necessarily having to retreat to the old extremist ethno-nationalist positions that they had.
Looking at the bigger picture, finally, decades of violence, decades of unrest in Northern Ireland. We're seeing similar conflicts, if you will, in places like Iraq, in Kosovo, to a lesser extent now. But are there any lessons that we can draw from Northern Ireland?
I think there are some very important lessons from Northern Ireland that we can learn here. The first one probably is that what it really takes is a long-term and unwavering commitment to a peaceful solution. I think with all the mistakes that may have been made since the late 1960s, when the violence really erupted in quite a big way in Northern Ireland, with all the mistakes that may have been made in the period between then and 1998, I think there always has been this commitment from British and Irish governments as the main mediators, but also to some extent conflict parties, to come to a solution, to achieve kind of an institutional framework within which the parties could work out their differences without having to resort to violence. But we also need to consider that this was a really long process. I mean, we had the first agreements, so to speak, in 1973, 74. So-called Sunningdale Agreement, but it only lasted for 3 months, and then it was brought down by massive opposition, interestingly by a coalition led by Ian Paisley. So I think from that perspective, the first lesson probably would be one of persistence. You need to persist in your efforts, but also, and this I think is the second lesson, there is an enormous degree of flexibility required from the people who mediate or who try to facilitate solutions. In the sense they need to be able to find solutions that really address as many as possible of the concerns that the individual parties have. So if we look at Northern Ireland. I mean, many people would say, well, 1973, Sunningdale is not really that different from 1998 agreement or from the St. Andrews Agreement in 2006. And on the surface, this might well be the case, but I think there are some very interesting innovations, some very interesting nuances. And it is this level of detail very often that is required in order to make sure that all the parties really find their interests are respected, that their demands are taken into account, but also that they can turn around to their constituents and say, okay, we have achieved a really good deal here for you. This is really what will secure your long-term future, your long-term aspirations. And I think this is very often something that is missing from a lot of peace agreements that are being negotiated at the moment or that have been negotiated in the past, where it's much more about short-term gratification, assuring political leaders in particular that their positions aren't threatened, rather than thinking ahead what might happen in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years time. So I think these are probably the two most important lessons that we can draw from Northern Ireland. And the third one that I would offer is certainly to think about that what we really need is solutions that in the end allow the full participation of the people in the actual conflict zone. So it may not always be your model Westminster or German style or French style or American style democracy, but we need to allow for meaningful engagement of the people in the conflict zone so that they also feel that they own this process, that they own the peace, that they benefit from the peace that will follow. So from that perspective, I think it's important to bear in mind that it's not only about making leaders sign on the dotted line of an agreement, but it's also giving them the ability to bring their constituents along and to implement and operate whatever peace agreement they sign up to at the negotiation table.
Yeah, the feeling you get at the moment is that people of Northern Ireland are very much in support and quite happy with what's happened. You don't generally see any reports about people complaining or protesting. So
I think that that's a very valid point. And if you compare that, for example, to the situation in Iraq, where, yes, we have a constitution that was negotiated and was approved in a referendum by the people of Iraq, none of which is completely dissimilar to the situation in Northern Ireland, if you look at the sort of process after 1998. But then on the other hand, you still have thousands and thousands of people killed in Iraq. You have a massive international military presence. So despite formally doing a very similar process to what happened in Northern Ireland, in terms of the substance, in terms of the substantive support that ordinary people and some elites give to the, well, one can't even call it peace process in Iraq, but to the process that is in place in Iraq, there is a very, very significant difference. And on that basis, I would say that it really is necessary to take account of some of the other lessons of Northern Ireland that I just mentioned. And you could make a similar case with the situation in Afghanistan. You can look to the Western Balkans. I mean, look at Kosovo, look at Bosnia, look at Macedonia.